Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we have a great guest. We're going to be talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urquetta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. Just trying to say that title and think about what it all means was actually really exciting to me, because as one thinks about flying into space and the challenges and the possibilities and the future mission to Mars, this is captivating. I think it's one of the things that brings people together, that brings us hope and aspirations of what we can do. We know that this is going to require tremendous advancements in technology. And here we're going to be talking about the advancements in health with one of the experts who works at the Baylor College of Medicine, works in NASA. First, though, we're going to talk about some exciting research that matters. And the first one is about physical activity, not in space, but here on Earth. And it's research about when one starts physical activity, does it make a real difference? And we've really talked many times on Your Health about the benefits of physical activity, that the longer one does it, the more those benefits accrue, that any amount of physical activity, it does seem to help. And now this research in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Open Network really shows that it's never really too late. They actually looked at data on 315,000 adults ages 50 to 71 who they followed for 14 years. And they were looking at those who had been inactive up until that point in time and those who had been active during this whole point in time, including that. And they basically found that if you were active before they started surveying you and you continued to have physical activity, you had a third less likely to die of any cause during the study period. And certainly, it was the strongest benefit. As we already stated, the more you were active, the better the outcomes. But let's say you were physically inactive at age 40. This study shows that if you started moving and getting your physical activity when you were between these ages, compared to those who didn't do that sort of activity, you were 35% less likely to die of all causes in the study than if you were to stay inactive. So you can repeat after me, I pledge to start becoming more physically active if I haven't become physically active, or at least to think about pledging to start becoming more physically active. Our next research that matters really looks at the other side of the spectrum, not in the older population, but a younger population. This is our adolescents, and particularly a study of 900,000 teens in 45 states who participate in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, one of the largest surveys that happens on a regular basis of teens in the United States, and sponsored by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they were actually looking in this particular study to see what happened to children and adolescents in terms of either being threatened or injured with a weapon at school, whether these teens reported carrying a gun at any location, whether they missed a day of school due to feeling unsafe because of guns and weapons in states that had very strict laws or stricter laws compared to states that had less strict laws. This was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. And what they found, this is from research out of Boston College, is that looking at things like gun access, whether or not there were gun safety laws, and whether gun manufacturers' liability was included, they came up with scores for each state, and they found that stronger gun control laws in a state was associated with a little less than a percentage point decrease and the probability of being threatened or injured with a weapon at school, a close to 2% decrease in the probability of carrying a weapon in any location, and a 1% decrease in the probability of missing school. During the studies, state laws became stricter in 17 states and weaker in 17 and stayed the same in 11 states. Now, this does not prove that stricter gun control laws result in safer teens. That research needs to be done. But it does suggest that there's something worth doing more extensive research here. And I think that these outcomes that they're looking at are ones that maybe should be thought about. Missing school, feeling safe. It's not just the mass murders, because they're killings and injuries are happening every day across the United States. This is a epidemic. It's one that needs more research. And if indeed it shows that these stronger laws lead to less adolescent injuries and make the kids safer, then those things should be done. The next research that matters is, again, moving around in the age spectrum. But here we're looking at the oldest people in society, those who perhaps are suffering from dementia or memory problems or ill health, and they're being cared for by family members. We call them caregivers. And the research is looking at the caregiver's health. And there's been research that a lot of people think has been the kind of the mantra, which is that the more you care for people like your parents or loved ones, that the more your health may suffer, maybe because of immune dysfunction or inflammation. And these researchers from Johns Hopkins, publishing in The Gerontologist, The Aging, really wanted to study whether that was really true, given that 34 million people are caregivers in the United States, and the cost of this caregiving is $375 billion. So, you know, should people who are doing caregiving worry? Now, it's not why they do it, but should they worry that their health is going to suffer? And they looked at 30 original papers that met pretty strict criteria. It's called a meta-analysis, this large review, and they found that there was a very small effect. It was statistically significant, but they said it was such a small effect, it may not be clinically relevant, so that there is some impact on health of caregiving, but it's not nearly as large as people have said in the past. I personally don't think people decide whether or not they're going to caregive based upon concerns about their health. It's because of what you do to care for your loved ones. But I do think there's something worthwhile knowing that you can take care of yourself, and caregiver support groups are critically needed. Our last research that matters is about what any of us would do if we wanted to acquire a new skill. And most of us would say, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Well, you practice, practice, practice. This research suggests that may not be entirely true. There may be more to that story. This is research published in the journal Current Biology. And it looked at in the National Institutes of Health Neurological Disorders and Stroke Laboratory, what happens when people are practicing a skill. In this particular case, they were in a scanning technique called magnetoencephalography. I'm just hoping that our great health science librarians can find one of these and put an image on this on our website, because it's a chair facing a computer screen under a long cone-shaped brain scanning cap. It does perhaps look like the Wizard of Oz or on Harry Potter, but be that as it may, what they actually had the volunteers doing is they were typing numbers as many times as possible, left hands for 10 seconds, 10-second break, and repeated it for alternating practice and rest 35 times. It doesn't sound like the most exciting research to participate in, but under the scans, what they were looking at is how well they correctly typed the numbers. And what happened was the typing of the numbers associated with the brain waves and the errors with rest or with activity. And what they found is that the brain waves change more during the rest periods than the typing periods. And so learning seemed to be actually happening during the rest periods. And so really fascinating that the performance improved primarily during short rest, not during typing. And so it may be that these rest periods actually are what are key to actually learning a new skill and performance improving. So things like perhaps playing a sport, you're going to practice it, but then you got to take a rest. If you're doing the piano, practice it, but then take the rest. Or more importantly, perhaps rehab for patients that are trying to learn to get function after a stroke or after a neurological injury. It's the rest periods that may be just as important as the practice. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urquetta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, I'm talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urqueta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. Welcome, Dr. Urqueta.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for having me.
I must say, when I came in to the studio and I heard what we were talking about and who we were talking to, I got excited. How often does that happen? People, they come to hear you speak and they say, I'm excited.
We do very exciting things, and even for me, I have been doing this for a few years now, and every day that I come to the office, I still feel like a kid playing with space and doing what I have always wanted since I was a kid. So this is very, very exciting, and it's an absolute privilege to work for the space program.
Well, you are a physician, and I suspect that there is a very small subset of physicians in the world who are interested in aerospace medicine. Tell us, how did you get interested, and what was your path?
Yeah, so ever since I remember, I have always wanted to work in something related to aviation or space. My dad is an aerospace engineer, and since I was a kid, he always took me to see the airplanes and to be in the cockpits, and you know, everything that I have on my childhood memories have to do with aviation. Then I was wanting to be a pilot, but I also wanted to have a family, so you know, it's difficult to be a pilot and have a family, so that changed my decision. And then I decided to go to medical school, completely unrelated to space or to aviation. And after I completed medical school, I worked for Helicopter Emergency Medical Services in Mexico City. Mexico City is a city with 20 million people, and there's a single helicopter emergency medical services provider for the entire 20 million city. So we were kind of busy all the time flying the most critically ill patients in the city. And that's when I was very happy that I was able to combine my passions, medicine and aviation. And then after that, I moved to the U.S. and I did a master's degree in aerospace medicine at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And then after that, I was able to participate as a crew member, as a test subject in one of the NASA analog missions that tried to simulate how people react to being isolated and confined on similar missions to what we're planning to go to Mars. And then after that, I guess that the pathway is really connected, and then I was able to get the job that I have now.
Well, there's so much to unpack there and so many exciting experiences. I must say, I'm not certain that becoming a physician is any less demanding on the family. It's a difficult path either way, and certainly now that you're combining those two. You know, when I think about aerospace medicine, it's not the first thing I think about when I think about aerospace. When I think about aerospace, I think about, oh, it's the technical challenges of getting into space, the safety of the crew to get up and to get down, and the reentry. But clearly, that's an archaic or an arcane way of thinking about it. And I realize that the health and safety of the people that are flying these missions is the first and foremost area of concern.
Absolutely. Everything that we do every single day, since we wake up until we go to sleep, our main priority is crew safety. And specifically, we're working for the mission to Mars. Well, recently, you know, the Space Council and the Vice President made the statement that we're going to go to the moon first. But still, some of the challenges from the medical standpoint and from the psychological standpoint are very similar. You know, the distances are astronomical. There's huge distances between the Earth and the Moon and Mars. And some of the concerns are very similar. For example, the main concern that we have is radiation. You know, we here on Earth, we are very protected from the magnetic layers, from the magnetosphere. So even astronauts on the space station, you know, we are talking here and there's astronauts flying at about 75,000 miles an hour around the Earth. Every 90 minutes, they make an orbit, so every 45 minutes, they see this, the sunlight. And, you know, we have been doing that for about 20 years now, and we have become pretty, pretty safe on doing these space flights. But, you know, for Mars, it's going to be very, very different. And the astronauts are not going to be protected from radiation, so that's our main concern. In addition, there's also behavioral concerns from the astronauts being isolated in a very small tin can for about 3 years. Also, the challenges from having enough food and enough medications for that trip, and a bunch of logistical challenges.
I remember asking colleagues, you know, this kind of exercise in knowing what are the most important medicines. And the question always goes like this. If you're stranded in the desert, you know, on an island, and you're by yourself, what three medicines would you want to have? You want them to say prednisone, an antibiotic, and like, you know, one other thing, depending on whatever skin condition or thing they may have. What are the essential medicines do you have to have on prolonged flight? Do you need a formulary, almost like a mini pharmacy? And who makes that decision?
So there's a huge list of medications that currently fly on the space station. There's more than 100 medications. And of course, for the mission to Mars, again, it's very different. So some of those medications will have to be changed. But yeah, I mean, that list is very, very comprehensive. It goes anywhere from Tylenol for headaches all the way to antibiotics. It's a very, very comprehensive list.
And I imagine even though these are healthy people, you have to have emergency medications and emergency things like a defibrillator or something like that. And do those things work in space?
Oh, yeah. So there's a defibrillator just in case something happens. Up to date, there has never been a big emergency on the space station on the 20 years that the station has been on orbit. You know, there's always the capability to deorbit one of the capsules and bring the astronauts back to Earth within a few hours, but that has never had to be done. So, you know, astronauts are one of the healthiest human beings that you will ever meet. They are absolutely fit. Some of them are military. They're very, very strong from the mindset. They have really advanced degrees. So, I mean, they're really, really incredible people. And, you know, they really don't get sick when they go to space. So really, from the medical perspective, this is really a paradigm shift from really the medicine that we practice on Earth, where, you know, you have a sick patient and then you have to treat that patient to have the person back to health. And then when we deal with astronauts, we are dealing with the healthiest people and preventing them from getting sick, from being exposed to the space environment.
We're talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urqueta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute of Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. And it sounds as if, you know, when you watch the TV movies on space, the final frontier, what seems to be really tricky oftentimes isn't necessarily the immediate physical challenges, it is the psychological challenges. And I wonder then, since these are really healthy, you do have some significant psychological considerations, like isolation or boredom for long stretches of time. Is that true?
Absolutely. And that's, like I was talking to you at the beginning, that's one of the main concerns that we have. Current space station communications are pretty much real time. The astronauts can talk to their families with phone or video conference pretty much anytime they want. Now, when we go to Mars, there's going to be a time delay between 20 and 40 minutes. So this means that, you know, if you want to talk to your family while you are flying to Mars, you say hello, and then 20 to 45 minutes after that, you will hear back from them. So imagine being in such a position that you cannot have any real-time input from anybody, not from your wife, not from your husband, from your friends, from your physician. So every single thing that astronauts have to do in these missions need to be completely autonomous and self-reliant. In addition, probably the spacecraft that goes to Mars is not going to have windows, because of the radiation and because windows are very heavy. So the food is going to be probably limited. You know, there's going to be no fresh food. So all these things combined really, really have, there's a price that has to be paid for those things. And, you know, us and the space program are really, really working very hard to make sure that we have enough countermeasures to make sure that astronauts are safe and that they feel happy during these missions.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but then we're going to continue talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urqueta about how the human body fares on the final frontier, looking at the medical effects of prolonged space travel. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Manuel Urquieta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. And right before the break, Dr. Urquieta, you really kind of began to let us know some of the health issues that these are healthy astronauts, but they all face some common challenges, whether it be radiation or for long stretches of isolation and boredom and communication, maybe being in a very closed, tight space. How is the technology that you're looking at trying to impact some of these physical and psychological health challenges?
Well, our institute, the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, TRISH, we were awarded a grant from NASA. We worked through a cooperative agreement. We're all based at Baylor College of Medicine here in Houston, Texas. So we have been asked by NASA to find new approaches to really the same problems. So we are trying to find very, very new approaches and new technologies. We like to call high risk but high reward approaches, and also bringing new investigators, very young investigators that have new ideas and really paradigm shifting approaches to the same old problems.
What would be a high risk, high reward type scenario?
Well, for example, artificial intelligence, something that we are working heavily, especially for medical problems for long duration missions, like we're talking on the first segment. You know, if there's a medical condition on the mission to Mars, the astronauts will not have the capability to, you know, grab the phone and call Houston and have a flight surgeon talking to them. So really, we need to enable the astronauts to have the capability to diagnose themselves, to initiate the treatment, and then just to confirm that the treatment is right with a flight surgeon from mission control. So this is something that hasn't been developed before. So we are pioneers in developing this type of technologies. So that's one example.
Wow, interesting. Now, you yourself participated in a prolonged simulation, I understand, something called the Health Exploratory Research Analog. Tell us about that, because I think it's one thing studying it and researching it, it's another experiencing it firsthand.
Yeah, so it's the HERA, the Human Exploration Research Analog. So it's a simulation that NASA conducts here in Houston at Johnson Space Center. So they have four missions a year. They call each four missions a campaign. And they try to simulate a real mission to space. So I was one of the participants on these missions. I spent 30 days inside, we like to call it tin can, with three additional people. And we simulated pretty much the same psychological and the same food limitations that we were talking. You know, there's no communications with the outside world besides mission control. There's no windows. There's, of course, no internet, social media, nothing like that. The food is limited. You know, it's a kind of small place to be there. So really, you have to be as best friends as possible with the rest of the crew members, because there's no door that you can just open and leave in real life when the astronauts go to Mars. So really, crew selection is critical for this. And the way we design the interior of these spacecraft also needs to be carefully thought. You know, the colors, the light, the textures, everything needs to be thoroughly thought on these missions. So NASA conducts, again, these missions on a regular basis, mainly to seek answers from the psychological standpoint.
Can you give us an example of what was perhaps surprising to you about that experience and maybe something that was really difficult for you about that experience?
Yeah, so when I participated in the mission, my daughter was 2 years old. So, you know, being away from my family was the most challenging part for me. Also, the food. Again, the food is limited and it is not as tasty as the food that we normally eat on Earth. So probably those were the main challenges. Luckily, in the specific mission that I did, all the crew members, we were really, really able to work together. And as a matter of fact, they are still close friends to me after, you know, years that I was able to do that mission.
Did you lose weight?
Actually, I did not. They give you enough calories not to lose weight or not to gain weight. In addition, we have to do about 2 hours of exercise every day.
Wow.
It's exactly what they do on the space station to avoid losing muscle and bone. So all of those things are pretty much the same as they work on the space station. So probably just maybe less than half pound a difference of weight. But yeah, I mean, throughout the 30 days, my weight was pretty consistent.
And tell me about your research, because there's so many unanswered questions here. What are two or three of the most burning things that you think need to be answered through research and maybe that your lab and others are working on?
Yeah, so we fund the research. We do not perform the research ourselves. We solicit and then we select research throughout the country. We choose the best investigators in the U.S. So we're heavily investing, our portfolio is heavily invested in radiation. Again, is the number one challenge to deep space missions. And we are tackling this problem from different perspectives, from genes, the genes therapy, from the microbiome therapy. It's such an array of different technologies that we are investing in this. Because radiation in space is very, very different from radiation on Earth. Here on Earth, if you go to take x-rays or any other imaging at the hospital, usually you think of lead, and you use a lead apron, and you'll be protected from radiation. But you cannot use this in space. In space, radiation is very, very fast, and it has a lot of energy. So physical shielding doesn't work that good. And then in addition, radiation is chronic and low dose. So the normal mechanisms that the body has to heal itself from radiation damage do not work ideally in space, because they're constantly being bombarded with radiation. So we need to have a different approach, more from the biological side of research. So that's where we have heavily invested from our portfolio.
Now, it's clear that the mission to Mars means something to you more so than perhaps the average American. You know, you think about landing on the moon, and three countries have successfully landed people on the moon. Recently, the Israelis were landing, but something went awry. But a mission to Mars is in and of itself outlandishly crazy, but it's going to happen, correct?
We will make sure that when it happens, the astronauts are going to be absolutely healthy, and that they will go to the mission and they will come back as healthy as possible as we send them. That way they come back to their families and friends. So like I was telling you at the beginning, it's an absolute dream, specifically for me, to be part of this, to be part of the space program.
Why is that dream? I know in your bio you talk about that you are a patriot. Why is that patriotic sense in this mission to Mars so important to you?
Well, I think that I really feel very privileged to be part of this, because I am a first-generation immigrant. I am a naturalized U.S. citizen. So I absolutely feel absolutely privileged and, you know, in a unique position to give back to this amazing country that we have. And you know, there's very, very few places in the world where you can do this. I would say just maybe China recently, Russia, a little bit in the European Union and the U.S. And the U.S. is the country with the biggest investment on space research. So, you know, being able to say that is an absolute privilege to me.
Well, I think it's a privilege for us at Your Health to talk with you, Dr. Urquieta, about your research, about your vision, about the vision of the Translational Research Institute for Space Health and the work that you're doing. We want to, you know, thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you and your audience.
Well, I'm hoping in that when we get closer to these types of missions that you'll rejoin us for an update on the final frontier.
Absolutely. It was my privilege.
We've been talking with Dr. Emmanuel Urquieta, Senior Research Portfolio Manager at the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, about how the human body fares on the final frontier. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send a comment or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My wife is pregnant with our first child. Our OB has told us that anyone who will be spending a lot of time with the baby should get a whooping cough booster. When I told my stepmother this, she looked skeptical and said that she didn't have to get one when my nieces were born. I wasn't really expecting any pushback on this. What can I say to emphasize how important this is for baby's health?
Well, first off, I think there's a lot in this question here.
Yeah, it seems to be.
Well, we got three generations here that we're worrying about. We're worrying about the child, but we got the mother and how she feels about things, and then the grandmother. And what we'd like to get is everyone aligned. The child can't advocate for themselves.
No, not yet.
Right. And I think if we were to ask that newborn, what would you like to do to live the greatest, healthiest life? Would you like people to be immunized around you to avoid you? You know, they would probably say, yes, I would.
Yes, please. Yeah.
And we know the mother probably is saying, yes, please.
Yeah.
But yet the grandmother is saying, not so quick. So, you know, from the one vantage point, you just want to, you know, you don't want to shake someone's like, get on board here.
Yeah.
But I do think it's reasonable to say, why do you feel this way? We heard that, you know, well, the other children, maybe it didn't happen. But we know times change and standards change and expectations change and more research comes out. I mean, I saw a case of whooping cough in a six-month-old recently at UNC hospitals. It was tragic. Luckily, they survived, but they were in intensive care for several weeks. It was so difficult. And, you know, we know that this happened in part because they were not vaccinated and they were exposed. And so I think this is a real issue. It's not it's not an issue that's make-believe here. And, you know, I think it's up to then the mother to decide how they're going to respond.
Right.
And so, but you'd like to say, what would it take to get you to actually want to do this? Maybe that's the question to ask of the grandmother.
Yeah.
We use the motivational interviewing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
What would it take to get you to
gentle
want to
gentle nudging to get.
Would you be willing to go to the doctor's appointment with me, with my obstetrical provider? Would you be willing to go talk with your doctor about
this?
So again, you can get some shared decision making.
Right. Sounds wise. Has this been something that you've seen people, physicians, recommending more in the past few years as these rates have increased, or has this always been a recommendation?
Well, I would say over the last 5 or 10 years, the evidence-based guidelines recommend this vaccination for those who are going to be around newborns. When did that become a standard of care? Certainly not in the last 2 years, but you know, it may not have been more than 10 or 15 years ago. So guidelines are changing. More evidence comes.
Right.
Should be done.
Okay, great.
What's our very next house call?
So we actually get this house call from a physician, and this physician says, this house call is from me and a colleague of mine. We're both physicians. My colleague recently asked my opinion about a patient she had who complained of back and leg pain in an email. She thought she might have a kidney infection. She said she did not have a fever, but her thermometer had broken, so she couldn't be sure. She'd been drinking lots of water, but she wanted the physician to call in an antibiotic. My colleague was uncertain how she should handle this, but she also knew the patient was unlikely to come in to be seen by her. And she was curious what my thoughts are, and I'm curious what yours are.
Yeah, wow. So we've got lots of layers here, too. And I'm glad we're getting some colleagues from healthcare professionals, because the complexity of what happens and what doctors and other healthcare professionals have to think about is very intense at times. And what might seem easy, you know, may not be anything serious. Sure, why don't I call in some antibiotics?
Right.
Well, we have allergic reactions to antibiotics all the time. We have resistance from antibiotics. I would say a majority of times when people think that there's a urinary tract infection, it may not be. You know, it could be 25, 30%. It's not 100%. So we don't really know if this would be needed. On the other hand, we do know that it's difficult for people to get in.
Right.
And if the person's not going to come in, so sometimes what I'll say is, let's monitor this for 24 hours if there's no real risk. Let's see how you're feeling in the morning. Or we do shared decision making. You know, we could do this, but there are risks to doing this.
Right.
And I don't know if it's going to help you and getting shared decision making. So it's not necessarily the physician's full decision alone. Some physicians may come down the line and say, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to practice, quote unquote, bad medicine. But I think there's also real world medicine.
Right.
And that is sometimes more difficult. And I think it's negotiation.
Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. Well, I hope that one turned out okay.
The patient thinks it's a good plan.
Yeah. Do we have any other like healthcare provider questions?
We do. Yes,
oh,
we have one
okay.
more.
I had a feeling.
Yeah. So this question is from a healthcare provider about an increased emphasis on documenting advanced care planning and power of attorneys in the healthcare systems. they've noticed that outreach efforts to elderly patients are not just occurring for primary care physicians as a result, but also specialists. And they ask, do you think this is a good idea, or are there unintended consequences to this development?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we do in medicine for the right reason at the right time and the right population. And this is probably one of them. We have way too many people that are going around who are ill, getting sicker, and families maybe are more isolated, and discussions don't occur about what their wishes are towards the end of life or when they get sicker. And so the default mechanism too often is, let's do everything all the time. And that may not be what, and frequently isn't what people want as they get sicker and sicker. And at the same time, the primary care physician may not be at the central forefront of their mind when their patient's coming in with high blood pressure and diabetes and asthma to think about, oh, let's talk about also your wishes. And so that conversation doesn't occur. So there are a lot of academic health centers and community health centers where they're trying to encourage these conversations, and they may do direct outreach to patients. That's kind of like saying, you know, you need to have your mammogram. You may need to have your checkup done. We've noticed that through looking at your hospital records that you've not expressed preferences, but yet you may be at higher risk. So it could be we encourage you to have that conversation with your provider. That's one way of doing it. It may be that they're willing to invite you in to have a conversation with someone who maybe has the time to do it. I think always asking the physician, are you comfortable with that? So I think getting some permission from the physician about that and asking the physician, what would you like to do, would be the best way. I would think it'd be a little bit uncomfortable direct outreach and someone who doesn't know you and say, I want to talk about whether or not you're going to live or die. You know?
Right. Yeah. That's not,
that's a real risk.
Phone call.
So I do think it's the right reason at the right time. And I think involving the physician or the specialist in this conversation and giving them some options, but putting more attention to it is the right thing.
Great.
What's our very last house call?
I've heard you mention value-based care several times, and I'm wondering what sort of conditions do you think it's reasonable to talk with a physician about rather than coming into the office? That's definitely an easier thing to do for many instances.
Yeah, I think virtually most patients would rather not come in the doctor and watch your blood pressure go up when they take your blood pressure, you know, or step on the scale and see the weight go up beyond what you think you weigh.
Yeah.
So I get it. It happens to me as well. On the other hand, there are so many things that that conversation does in person or the examination does that you may not be able to do over the phone. On the other hand, you can do a lot over the phone. So we had an example earlier about getting information and whether someone has a cold or the flu or a urinary tract infection. This does breed uncertainty, though. So you're making some decisions with more uncertainty. So there's going to be a trade-off between certainty and uncertainty.
Right.
And I think everyone has to be aware of that, that you may have a little less certainty, but what you may gain is either getting something done quicker, time, money, and perhaps not sacrifice satisfaction, which is the thing that you, and quality of care. You got to make sure quality stays high, satisfaction stays high. Those two things, if you can do that, then you can treat these things. I think the conversations about healthcare planning, advanced care directives, that could be done over the phone. These are conversations that really need to have, but it needs to be done with probably someone who does know you or would take the time to know you. You don't really want all of telemedicine being done by people who've never met you or don't know anything about you. You'd like it to be done with people who know you and care about you.
You want it to be a little personal, even if it's not face-to-face.
And knowing that they do care about your health. Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues important to you, and you can share any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd really like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Emmanuel Urquetta. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.